What made you think we need a new Nginx slash Apache in the world? Welcome back to the Backend Banter podcast, where we talk about backend engineering and careers. Before I introduce today's guest, I want to tell a little story of how I met him in real life. So last year I was at Go West conference and I was talking to a mutual friend, and one of his friends walks up and starts talking to us as well. And I, of course, I'm like, oh, hi, nice to meet you. I'm Lane. And my friend is like, wait, you don't know who this is? Like, I'm meeting someone famous. And I'm like, no, I don't. He's like, this is Matt Holt. He made the Caddy server, which at the time didn't really mean anything to me. I was like, I actually kind of just felt embarrassed that I didn't know what Caddy was. I later realized that I did know what Caddy was. And in fact, I'd been seeing it on the front page of Hacker News and had already read all about it. Just didn't make the connection in my head that this was the guy who made that thing. And that thing is called Caddy. But ironically, the second thing that my friend mentioned, which was that Matt also created the website JSON2Go or JSON2Go. I use that thing every day. So like, ironically, that was the thing that impressed me, even though it's just just a little web app. So I'm here with Matt. Matt, do you want to take just a second and introduce yourself?
Yeah, that's funny. I'm not famous. I'm like Taylor Otwell level of famous or something like that. But so it's kind of funny to hear you say that, because I'm like, you can look at the Caddy repo on GitHub and it has, I think we just passed 50,000 stars. I don't know how you use GitHub stars, but I'll star repo where I think something's cool and but I'm not using it as like a bookmark to come back to it, but I never do. So I know there's at least 50,000 people not using Caddy. It's funny. So JSON2Go is, it's not a Go project. I see it show up in a bunch of like Go newsletters and stuff, and it's written in JavaScript.
Yeah.
We do actually use Dmitry Shuryulov, I don't know how to say his last name, contributed like a GoFumped, compiled down to WASM, I think.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And contributed that to the project, so that formats the output. But yeah, it basically converts your JSON example to a Go structure.
Yeah. And I literally used it almost every day for most of my career as a Go developer. And that's why when our friend said, this is Matt Holt, like the name kind of rung a bell, because your name is right there on the project. So I'd like seen it every day and just didn't make the connection.
Yeah, that's super funny. Yeah. So that took like a few hours. I took like half a day off work and to work on it, because I needed it for work. And
yeah.
I didn't realize it would be so popular. That was back in Go is pretty new. And so there probably wasn't a lot of tooling around it yet, but I was like, I need this. And, you know, my recursion practice from college came in handy there. And
yeah,
I don't know, but
parsing trees.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense why it would be so popular. Like, at least, again, most of my career has been writing Go, and most of that time has been writing JSON APIs. And so like, just a big source of issues in JSON APIs is just taking a JSON structure and getting the Go structure without like typos and stuff. And so having a machine that just does it for you, it's faster and less error prone.
Yeah. And there's a ton of tools out there that do this nowadays and for all sorts of languages and frankly do it better. So I'm glad people still use JSON2Go, but yeah. How did you start using Go? I don't know if I know your background.
That's a great question. So I actually just had my professor on the pod. It's probably not, once this one's released, probably like 10 episodes back. But I had a professor down at Dixie State University, now called Utah Tech University, that used Go for his distributed systems class. And that was my introduction to the language. And then I actually used Go by choice at my first job. I was like, oh, I think Go would be really good for this little kind of... It was a weird project where we were like slapping hardware sensors up on bridges and like reading voltage data. But it had to be done concurrently, and like writing it in Go just felt really elegant compared to like the Python that we used for most other things. I didn't have to like use the threading library or any weird stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that was like how I got into it. And then of course, like after that, I just went and like searched for Go jobs and then just kind of worked in.
That's awesome.
Whoever sent.
Yeah. That's a similar story here. I used it a lot in college. I was introduced to it through my work at the time. I worked at Smarty Streets. Now they're called Smarty. They were switching from C#. And, so we're kind of exploring Go, and, it turns out, so I had to do my parallel processing, you know, distributed computing class in C, and that, well, C++, that kind of sucked.
Yeah.
I did a lot of Python stuff, machine learning classes and things, but it turns out all my Go projects where I was able to choose my language in my classes performed way better than my classmates. We're using the same algorithms for the most part, mm-hmm. but just, you know, a lot of my classmates, Java, you know, JVMs were like running out of memory, and the Python versions were really slow, and the C programs had all sorts of seg faults. But my programs like were built quickly and just hummed along. And it was kind of a life hack for, you know, a college student.
Yeah, that was kind of the same experience that I had at this company. Like when I wrote this script that we were using Python for into Go, it just felt like everything got easier. Like it was easier to express concurrency, right? I guess obviously Python doesn't compile, so like there's a little bit about like compile times, but slapping a Go executable onto either an embedded system or like a Raspberry Pi with very little compute resources. We were actually using Raspberry Pi Zero at the time. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier than like installing a full Python interpreter.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Go is kind of a dream. So I've been really happy with that.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about Caddy. So, I mean, JSON2Go is a really cool project. Everyone should go check it out, but like you'll pretty much figure out how it works within about 5 seconds. That's the beauty of it. Caddy, on the other hand, is a very big project that essentially is like, I mean, it's competing with like Nginx and Apache, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it is.
And what made you think like we need a new Nginx/Apache in the world?
This was again me in college just spinning up a bunch of little websites for my school projects, and just getting really annoyed with configuring the same thing in Nginx and Apache over and over. And I just thought it was tedious, and I wanted something that worked a little better. And I was like, hey, Go is great for this, duh. And so, I mean, this is like, I think the idea originated in like 2013, so this is like a long time, 10 years ago now,
yeah,
and I started building it in 2014, and I actually had it working then, but it didn't get like announced or like published till 2015. But yeah, it was just this idea of, I just want to like open a text file. And I guess the idea kind of originated at the Caddy file, where it's like, I just want to say my site name or the address or whatever, and then hit enter, and then say what I want it to do. I want it to serve files, enter. I want it to compress, enter. I want it to whatever. So that was kind of how the Caddy file was born, and how the idea of Caddy was born. It was just a really simple wrapper over net HTTP, the Go package. Mm-hmm. But and then a couple classmates started using it and helping me build it and stuff. Like, oh yeah, this is useful, this is cool. And they were curious about Go. And so we had a couple like contributions there just before it was kind of like publicly announced and stuff. But so it initially was based on like easier setup and such. How much do you want me to go into like the evolution?
Yeah, no, that's great. Okay. So configuration, it sounds like, I mean, part of it's like, I want to write this fun new project in Go, and Go seems like a good fit, but it sounds like the motivation for the project was more around like ease of setup and configuration.
Sure. Yeah. Cause I could write a 10 to 100 line Go program to do what I need, like to be a server or this or that, and maybe even reuse that a bunch. But then it was just, I didn't want to like change a bunch of Go code every time I had a different site necessarily. I just wanted to change one or two lines in a text file.
Right.
So
just for the sake of some of our listeners, let's talk just a little bit about the difference between like maybe like a Go server that's like a JSON REST API and like what Caddy is. Because to new developers, that might feel a little blurry. So like, what problem do Nginx, Apache, and Kaddy solve versus like a company's like application server?
Like Apache came around in the days when websites were mostly static files, or if you had like CGI scripts and PHP, there was like, SAPEs and APIs and CGI is, you know, you run your process, it captures output, and that's the response you send to the client. It's a little slow and cumbersome, but it's really flexible, right? Like
a little scripting program, language, like almost like a little language, PHP.
Any whatever can conform to CGI spec and such. And so like Apache, for example, was a way to like serve static files, which were the most common website back in the day, and occasionally some dynamic content, some cool scripts and stuff. And then Nginx came along when the web started growing and performance was more of a concern because compute power was still very shared and virtual machines weren't really a thing yet. And so like we needed to really optimize performance. And so Nginx came around for that. And it can serve static files. It's actually not its forte. It's more of a proxy. And so like you see more like applications being served through like PHP. This was kind of the PHP boom. So what you do is you put up Apache and Nginx in front of your web applications that actually do business logic for you, or maybe they just serve static files, but those are the two most common use cases for a server in front of your site. And so, so Kaddy, it's written in Go, and you can write your web server in Go and your web application in Go, and you don't need a web server in front necessarily. But Kaddy fills this niche where, one, it upgrades. It's a more modern take on web serving than Nginx or Apache, and it's designed to continue to adapt to the modern web as it continues to change. It's written in Go, so you get memory safety, but a lot of people will use Kaddy in front of their Go applications because you can offload a lot of web logic, that web concerns that you don't want to have in your business logic. So like you can terminate TLS, so you can have secure connections with your clients, you can do rate limiting, you can do compression, you can also serve static files. Sure, that's one line of Go code with the standard library, but you can get a little more flexibility with Kaddy's pretty easily, things like that. So you want to separate your internet concerns with your business logic, and so you put a server in front typically.
Okay, that makes sense. There's kind of two use cases. There's the proxy, which is like what sits in front of my application server and deals with the like outgoing connections to the internet. Maybe does load balancing?
Yeah, load balancing. So anything dealing with like web traffic, HTTP. I mean, Kaddy is an HTTP proxy. So if your web application is designed to take in HTTP requests, you can still do that. But you could also just, if you want to terminate HTTP completely, you can do that too. Kaddy has other ways of communicating with your backend. So.
Right. Okay, cool. Yeah. I've used Kaddy quite a bit, and we actually use it in boot dev. It's like the server for the cool different courses where we need a static file server or a proxy or whatever. And that's not just because it's written in Go. It actually is just like way easier to set up. CP a Kaddy file, change a couple things. On that note, just really quick, the Kaddy file idea, was that inspired from the Docker file?
The name Kaddy file, yeah. I mean, actually, no, it wasn't Docker. It was Vagrant.
Oh,
I was using Vagrant for quite a few things. So Vagrant was more popular before Docker, I believe.
I think so.
It's been up a VM and scripted and automated and such. So we were using that. I was using that, and I was like, oh, the Vagrant file. Like that's kind of an elegant pattern. And then Docker came. I don't know who invented it, honestly. I just don't remember Docker being very big yet.
Okay, got it. So that's where the Kaddy file came from. One question I have is like, what made you decide to just kind of, I'm not super familiar with Vagrant other than just, I used it like once. But like the Docker file doesn't have an extension. It's just like the Docker file. Yeah. And Caddy file is the same way. Like it's just Caddy file, no extension. Mm-hmm. Yep. Why did you choose that way to do a config?
We didn't need an extension. Like it didn't make sense. Yeah, you, because these file, like this naming pattern is typical where you have like a folder that you want to designate as a particular a bundle kind of. So like a Vagrant file, you put in a folder that is, I think, part of your VM, if I remember correctly. A Docker file, okay. You put in a folder that is represents your Docker build. And Caddy, you put a Caddy file in a folder that represents your site. So you don't need different files. You just need the one in a folder. And you run right. Caddy in a folder with a Caddy file, and it just kind of works. It just finds it.
Got it.
Which is funny because with Caddy 2, version 2 that came out a few years ago, the Caddy file is not Caddy's native config language. We can get into that in a minute, but we do recognize that natively. And so if you designate a folder with a Caddy file in it, that is a site, a Caddy website.
Got it. Anytime you got a Caddy file, the intention is that it's a Caddy site. Mm-hmm. And that's why you don't need a file extension, because you'd never name the Caddy file anything other than just Caddy file.
Right. Like if it was named something else, we wouldn't be able to find it automatically.
Right. Okay.
Use it.
That makes sense. What is the like markup configuration language within a Caddy file? Like a TOML, JSON, like what?
Like what does the syntax look like?
Yeah.
It's kind of like what I described at the beginning where, yeah, you type your site name and hit enter. Type what you want it to do, hit enter, and it's, you can open blocks and sub configure things. And the Caddy file is not actually a great, it's not a great syntax. Those of us who go to college for computer science degrees, we study parsing, we study syntaxes and that kind of thing. But discrete structures and such, Caddy file is not elegant. It's not academically sound. It's very practical, but it definitely has a lot of, like, if you really dig in, a lot of the code's kind of ugly and stuff, but it's really nice to write and read.
So it's basically like just a text file.
It's just a text file. Yeah. There's no like semicolons or whatever. We'd use like curly braces, but everything's kind of white space limited. And
okay.
So yeah.
Cool. No, I mean, it makes sense. My guess is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that was probably like the absolute best user experience initially. And maybe it still is a really good user experience. But my guess is as complexity of the file grows is when it like gets hard to parse, maybe.
It gets hard to express certain things in the Caddy file because it is a very simple format. For example, a lot of people want properties of CSS in the Caddy file where things cascade in, or like they want Nginx's contexts or scopes where you can nest things and they all inherit. And some people want variables and reusability and kind of like scripting abilities in the Caddy. I'm like, just pre-process all that. The Caddy file is just, it's a simple, and now with Caddy 2, if you want to do something complicated, write JSON configuration. It's very very verbose, but you have a lot of control and you can script it and automate it much easier.
So in Caddy 2, you can use a JSON configuration file rather than the Caddy file?
Yeah. So Caddy 2 natively understands JSON. When you run it with a Caddy file, it's converted to JSON for you. But Caddy's only config format is JSON. And I say that in the sense that it's the only config format that it natively knows. Everything else is converted to JSON. So Caddy 2 has this idea of config adapters, which is really cool because now we've kind of ended the config format wars. If you want to use JSON, you can. When you use the Caddy file, you can. If you don't like either of those, you can use YAML. If you hate YAML like me, you can use TOML, which I don't use that. I use the Caddy file and JSON most of the time, but like you can use TOML, you can use Q, you can use HCL. There's all sorts of, you pick your language.
You can pick whichever markup you hate the least.
Yeah, basically.
Because we all, I've yet really to meet anyone that is in love with a configuration file format. It's just like we all hate them for slightly different reasons, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, Caddy 1, like we kind of, I didn't want to make a config format, like I didn't want to make it so complicated, and we would have configuration in the CLI. Some people like that. Another web server, Trafic, uses Docker labels for its configuration. Like there's so many ways to configure stuff, but we decided in Caddy 2, you know what? It's just a config file. It's a JSON document. That's it.
At least that's all you have to ever really parse it in, as long as you can convert from the other formats.
Exactly. Yep.
I'd imagine that can get a little weird, right? Like, don't some formats support things that JSON doesn't? I mean, I guess like with comments, you just strip them.
Yeah, but everything I know of compiles down to JSON.
Oh, okay. That's nice.
Like YAML has these weird, like, iterative abilities, like variables that you can, or references, I think. But once you evaluate it and compile it, it becomes a JSON document.
Got it. You just like expand it all out.
Yep.
That makes sense. So, okay. So we talked about how Caddy is useful as like a reverse proxy. It terminates SSL. It's a load balancer. It can serve static files. Are there any other like key features of Caddy that are missing from that list?
Yeah, two things. I would say one is public key infrastructure. So if you're running your own internal infrastructure, you need to secure things or authenticate things, Caddy can operate as a certificate authority. So
okay,
that's kind of neat. But I'd say the biggest one is it's a plugin ecosystem.
Wait, when you say a certificate authority, like it doesn't issue its own SSL certificates, does it?
It does. No one trusts them. Like your computer isn't going to trust my Caddy instances certificates, but
got it.
Yeah, anyone can generate their own certificates, including Caddy.
Right. Okay. Got it. So you can generate the cert. It's just that browsers and operating systems or whatever.
And Caddy will. We use a library by Filippo that actually will install its root into local trust stores. At least most of them, not all of them, but it does its best to get it in the most, so that when you serve like a local host site with Caddy, it will by default be on HTTPS. You can open your browser and it'll trust it. But yeah, if you want to use a particular Caddy instance's root CA on other machines, then you do have to like install that root CA into those machines.
So this actually, I think, is a really interesting like sidebar conversation especially for our listeners. On Boot Dev, we teach a cryptography course, and it's just like raw cryptography, right? We cover things like how SSL works, and even more kind of in particular, like how the encryption that goes on works under the hood. And in my experience with like HTTPS, SSL, the encryption part's the easy part, right? Like you just write code that does the encryption. You can make sure that it's secure. You're managing private keys. It's this authority part that's like the hard part. And like, that's why things like Let's Encrypt exist. Is Let's Encrypt like a service that Caddy uses automatically, or do you guys do something else? How do you manage all that authoritative stuff?
Encryption is not easy. It's easy when you have the right libraries that do it well. Yes. I mean, good APIs and such, and Go is pretty good at that. For example, there are other ecosystems where it's definitely not as good of a situation. But yes, presuming the encryption is implemented correctly, that's relatively easy for application developers. The hard thing is trust. The authority there. So certificate authority is the entity, technically speaking, it's the private key that has the authority or is trusted to sign public keys for other entities. And so Let's Encrypt is a publicly trusted one because it goes through all these procedures and there's protocols and audits and such that the public web browsers and operating systems and other clients, they trust Let's Encrypt to validate domain names in particular. In a robust way so that it can't be easily spoofed and such. And so that when people present a Let's Encrypt signed certificate, they can trust it. Like, oh yeah, this is this domain name genuinely.
Right.
So when Caddy goes to sign a certificate, I mean, Caddy like, or you, if the OpenSSL command line or whatever, you're not a publicly trusted authority. I mean, you can use that certificate. You can program your applications to trust that certificate. That root CA, but other people aren't going to trust it by default. So, I mean, that's kind of a hard problem. There are companies and software products like SmallStep that are working on solving that and have pretty good solutions. Ultimately, it comes down to usually like machine provisioning and like automating that with so that it installs the trust that you need. Yeah, so trust is the hard thing.
Seems to involve more like human communication, which is always really annoying.
It's very policy and yeah, it's not a, I worked for Let's Encrypt for a while and it's kind of a murky, like it's a very like just, yeah, policy thick, murky is not quite the right word. It's just very, it can be a little overwhelming. They're very good at what they do. It's just kind of a wild world. Like application developers wouldn't want to get into the weeds there.
But. Right. So just to recap, because I think to a lot of our listeners, this whole idea of like how we encrypt and decrypt the data as separate from like the authority piece might still be just a little fuzzy. So let's say that I have a server, an application server, and I deploy it up to the internet. It's got a public IP address and you can reach out and talk to it. And let's say I'm able to like give it a public key. It's able to use a private key to encrypt its message that's going to come back to me, and it sends me back an encrypted message. Why do I need more than that? Why do I need something additional on top of just the encryption to talk to that to that server?
Yeah, good question. So TLS, which we use on the internet or typically between machines to secure connections, you get three guarantees. And it didn't have to be implemented this way, but we'll explain why there's three guarantees in particular. There's authenticity, meaning you know that the message came from the sender. There's there's confidentiality, which means that no one else can read the message. And there's integrity, which means that no one can change the message without it being detected.
Okay.
So, you could implement encryption with like a password. That's not authenticated though. So like you can encrypt something with just a password but there's no guarantee that password isn't shared, for example. And so like, you don't know who the message came from or whatever. So that's not very useful for knowing who is behind something or associated with something. So private keys are nice because they are kept private and passwords are obviously shared. In order to encrypt with a password, you like a shared key, a symmetric key, you'd have to decrypt it with that. So you have to share it. Well, that's not going to work for the public because now the password is public.
You can't give every website visitor your private key, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Because then it's like, oh, this is my identity too. Like it's kind of weird. So, so we have asymmetric encryption, which is public-private key pairs. And so the private key is kept private, and through some awesome math, the public key can be shared with everyone and the two keys can kind of validate each other. And so if you can get a message signed by a private key, you can validate it using their public key, that it was in fact signed by the private key and that that entity does in fact have access to or control over the private key. So, I mean, yeah, you could imagine a world where you go to google.com and it's encrypted, but if it's not authenticated as genuinely being Google, that could be a problem, or like a bank website or whatever.
Right.
So you want to know that the domain name you're accessing is genuinely who they say they are.
And that's why we get certificates signed?
Yeah. So a certificate is a public key plus other stuff like signatures and algorithms and expiration dates and such.
So it sounds like the authentication part is really like all that extra metadata, like you said, signatures, timestamps, or dates of expiration. It's like that stuff is issued by some central authority that's basically saying, I know these people and they own that domain name. So it's not like just any server. It's like, I know the people that own this domain name also control that server that you're communicating with. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah, basically. So you need all that information in order to be able to trust that that domain name is controlled by who you think it is.
Got it. And so as you like, really at the end of the day, what you're trusting is whoever issued that, like whoever the authoritative entity is. So like maybe Let's Encrypt.
Yep. Yeah. So certificate authorities have a lot of power in that regard. And that's why there's certificate transparency, to kind of keep an eye, so the public can keep an eye on certificates that are being issued.
Like, I know that Caddy handles SSL termination kind of out of the box. That's, I mean, if you go to the Caddy website and look, it's like one of the biggest things that's kind of mentioned in like the H1 header and stuff. Like, does it just like use Let's Encrypt under the hood?
Caddy's automatic HTTPS, yeah, uses Let's Encrypt, uses zero SSL, and it can use any ACME compatible certificate authority.
Okay. So will it actually do the work of like running the Let's Encrypt program to actually like reach out, get the certificate, put it in the right place, like all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, there's no like Let's Encrypt program. Like, it's not a separate binary or anything or a script. It's just a protocol. And so Caddy.
Oh, okay.
You know, we speak that protocol. So yeah, we take care of that. As long as your server is publicly accessible to the internet, and your domain name's pointed at your server, that's all Caddy needs.
Got it. I think I'm thinking of, so Let's Encrypt is like the protocol and I'm guessing like the server and everything. I can't remember the name of the Python script that I used to use Let's Encrypt back in the day. Yeah. And in my mind, I think I coupled those things, but they're not actually coupled.
Certbot is, yeah, it's like
that's the EFFs. One. Certbot.
Yeah. Certbot is kind of the de facto standard. Although recently there was a question on the community forums at Let's Encrypt, and one of the Certbot engineers was suggesting they recommend Caddy as the default ACME client.
Ooh.
So
that's exciting.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, Certbot is a great tool to temporarily transition legacy sites to HTTPS, but I don't think it's a great long-term solution. I think ultimately it needs to be built into your server. And whether you're using Caddy or your own Go application or your own Node application or whatever, it just needs to be integrated.
No, that makes sense. I want to kind of explain to some of our listeners how I've done this sort of thing in the past, because I've worked a lot with production application servers, whether they're written in Go or Node or whatever. And oftentimes, for example, I'll deploy to either like a serverless platform or maybe like a Kubernetes cluster. And there is, I don't think I've ever really worked on, well, let's say in the last 5 years where I've been doing like more kind of modern cloud stuff. But in recent years, I haven't ever like deployed my own proxy server that does all of this like load balancing SSL type stuff. I usually just worry about the application server and it talks to a proxy over like raw HTTP. So like my server that I'm writing doesn't even care about HTTPS. And I actually think that's a sticking point for a lot of new developers. They don't realize that oftentimes in production application code, you don't need to worry about all this stuff because you just stick a proxy in front of it.
Yeah, and you really shouldn't. I mean, if you are integrating it indirectly into your application, the library you're using should really just take care of it. So like Go, I wrote one called CertMagic that does it all for you. Like instead of saying http.listenandserve, you say like, you know, certmagic.listenandserve kind of thing. But you really want it to be kind of no hassle because you do not want to get it wrong. It's a security sensitive thing and an availability thing. Is your certificate expires, now your site's down, service is down.
Yeah.
So like you really, yeah, you kind of want to offload it to something that specializes in it, whether it's a library that does it all for you. That means that you shouldn't have to be wiring up a ton of things as much as possible. You don't want to be setting up external scripts and tooling like Certbot. Again, it's a fine transition tool. They've done great work with it, but not great in long term and at scale especially. So yeah, I mean, putting a proxy in front is a great way to do it. There's a lot of hosted services that will do this too. I'm a huge fan of self-hosting for a lot of reasons, but anyway,
I mean, that makes sense. And if I self-hosted, I would almost certainly be using Caddy because I've used Nginx in the past and I wasn't a fan. I haven't even really done too much with Apache other than like when I've done some stuff in WordPress. It's like,
oh, yeah,
happened to be hosted with Apache and also not a fan. But okay, so in my experience when working with like proxies and load balancers, oftentimes I'll use like a managed one. So like AWS will deploy like a managed load balancer, or GCP has a similar thing going on. One thing I'm interested in is like under the hood, I'm guessing those managed services use something like Nginx, Apache, or Caddy. Is that part of like where you guys are trying to go with this project, is to like get it used like by the lower level cloud infrastructure?
Yeah, I think that would make a lot of sense. So like Cloudflare, for example, has their own Nginx implementation, or like their fork of Nginx, but I think they're replacing that with their own Rust based solution because Nginx is too slow for Cloudflare. Go programs, by the way, Go servers are fast enough for the majority of internet companies like Google and Netflix use Go at the edge. And so like Go is fine. If you're asking if Caddy or Go is fast enough, yes, it is. But yeah, so that said, but yeah, there's, I think a lot of places we would want to see Caddy is at these kind of more infrastructure levels because it is infrastructure software. There are companies that are using it that way, especially now that Caddy 2 has been out for a while. So we're seeing sites like Framer is using Caddy. There'll be, you know, Stripe is using it. They're a huge sponsor. Ooh. They're using it pretty heavily. So like, it definitely has its like large scale business use cases.
Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't realize Stripe was using it. I'm a huge Stripe fan.
Yeah, Stripe's awesome.
So one thing I'm always interested in with big open source projects like Caddy is like, what's the business model for a project like this? How are you able to spend all of your time and maybe even like, do you have employees? Do you have team members?
Yeah, good question. That's a big one. Initially, I mean, it's definitely not the default in an open source project. Because yeah, when I was in college and I was working on it, I had my undergraduate job and then I had my graduate research position and stipend from that and stuff that kind of covered my living expenses. And then as I finished my graduate degree, you know, you realize, oh, people are going to job fairs and it's time to get a job, you know? So I did that and did interviews, actually a couple of rounds. I did this for undergrad and graduate school. But for graduate school, I focused more on wanting to work on Caddy more full time. And so
was that a master's degree or a PhD?
Just a master's. Yep.
Okay, cool.
I don't have the patience for a PhD, but I have a huge respect for all doctorates out there. So the approach there for that second round was more like, I want to keep working on Caddy and it has business value. So how do I go about doing that? And I was fortunate to know Bill Kennedy a little bit. He actually reached out and was interested in Arden Labs kind of making the runway happen for Caddy version 2. So I was able to, at the end of grad school, after that ended, I was able to spend 9 months or so designing and building this thing full time. And that was time really well spent. And then I always had this thought in the back of my head, like, well, you know, if someone came along and like wanted to, I don't know, buy the project, I'd be willing to sell it and either move on or stick with it. I don't know, depending on the arrangement, but like, I don't know. Part of me was like, eh, like maybe I'm done. Well, an email came in a couple weeks after the end of our runway with Arden Labs, you know, and so that funding was up. And they offered to, there's this company in Austria that offered to buy the project. And I was like, oh.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, this is not like a VC funded thing. There's not millions of dollars at stake here. It was to a lot of these in comparison is pocket change, you know, but it was just enough to like hold me over for a few more months. And also part of the deal was to take me on and pay a development stipend basically to keep the project maintained. And they found value in that. You know, as we saw later, they ended up also acquiring Zero SSL. And so they have like a certificate authority as part of their holdings, you know, their ecosystem there. And so that worked out strategically for them to have an Acme client, several Acme clients actually, and Zero SSL, a certificate authority. Some of it was just luck. The company's finding value in an open source project, a strategic thing. And so anyways, so I continue developing it. And so I do rely now on sponsorships. And you know, we were with Arden Labs, we were going to make a Caddy Enterprise and we were going to lock down a lot of these advanced features with the plugin system. Partially was designed that way so that we could easily withhold features from the public and easily build Caddy with these enterprise plugins. And anyway, we decided not to do that. And Bill sat down with me. He's like, you know what? Let's just make it all open source. And so we canceled all our plans for anything proprietary. And I was like, Bill, how are we going to make money? And the answer, I think that he was right, is this idea of sponsorships is a really good way to go about it. And that works for our project. I've given talks on this, you know, subject. Yeah. And there's a lot of different approaches, but we really didn't want to just mess with licensing anymore. So it's all open source licensed, all the binary, like everything. It's just your standard vanilla open source. Like there's no funny business. And we just accept sponsorships. And that's what we require in order to keep developing the project. And so we have some really awesome sponsors. I don't know if you see our homepage now. I redesigned the website to kind of feature our sponsors more. And I'll keep developing the sponsor highlights there. I need to get some like info from them. But we have a good set of sponsors, you know, including Stripe, Zero SSL, tons of startups. We've got big companies too, like Mercedes-Benz. We know that they use it.
I see that, yeah. SourceGraph.
SourceGraph is... They've been solid with Caddy from the beginning. So there's a lot of value. Companies are realizing the value in sponsoring open source projects to keep them maintained, to prevent crises, various crises from happening.
Do all of your sponsors like pretty actively use Caddy?
Yeah, I think most of them. So, I mean, let's glance at the list. I mean, I think a couple of them integrate with it. So like Latool is the company behind API Platform and FrankenPHP, which mostly has been really hyped up this week because it came out with Laravel, Octane, and support and stuff like that. Okay. Framer's using Caddy. Yeah, a lot of these companies are using it. Some are not using it so much as they are just supporting it. So there's a lot of value there, though, that they capture because, so for example, a company like SourceGraph, maybe they are using it to some degree. I don't actually know entirely, but for companies like them, a lot of their users, their customers use Caddy. And so for them to sponsor Caddy is a really good look for their customers, and their customers are more loyal to their brand now. Like, oh, hey, SourceGraph is sponsoring this open source project that I use. That's awesome. I like SourceGraph, you know? And so that's really
good. It's more of a marketing and branding play for them rather than like a, we need to make sure this project doesn't die because our infrastructure will go down.
Right. Both are great reasons to sponsor.
But yeah, like, I mean, at the end of the day, in my experience, at least, like companies do want a reason to sponsor things. And it would make sense to me that it's probably going to be one of those two things. I mean, like, for example, Boot Dev, we sponsor creators for the most part, but it's that second reason, right? It's like basically a marketing and a branding thing.
Yeah. I mean, companies sponsor athletes all the time. You see a bunch of athletes and NASCARs and, you know, things like that. And then you've got tech companies that sponsor conferences, which are once a year, and they pour thousands and thousands of dollars into these that just are a couple of days long sometimes. And you could put that same amount of money toward an entire year of sustaining an open source project. In conjunction with other sponsors, of course, but it's very economical when you think of it like that. And I think more companies should do it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, Boot Dev is really small. The only open source company that we've sponsored so far was Codemere because we use it, right? And so it's like, I've actually been on the sponsoring side of like both of those situations where it's like, we use Codemere. We actually worked with him to ship a new feature and like sponsored the feature. I shouldn't say, I mean, there's a lot of people that have contributed to Codemere, but like the lead maintainer was the guy I was kind of talking to and working with
Oh, we got to get you up on the homepage. You got to get boot.dev up there.
Right.
I just threw that together really quick. So but let's do that. I'll do that after the show.
The business model for open source companies is fascinating to me. There's, like you said, there's a ton, and some work better than others. I think a lot of times it's situation dependent. On that note, just because I'm curious now, like obviously you're on it full time, so like you need to pay yourself for your time. Are there other people on the team?
We're getting there. We're at a point where like my living expenses are covered, but we need to kind of double that in order to adequately, I think, cover another full-time developer. I mean, I've thought about other options too, like part-time and whatever. Right now, we have an awesome core maintainer team that have volunteers.
Okay.
And I keep talking about like, okay, we need to get them paid. And I mean, they have full-time jobs that they're very good at and that they enjoy even. And some of them don't want to work.
Be full-time on Caddy.
Yeah. Or even paid part-time. Some people just enjoy participating in the community. But I'm sure that there are opportunities there. And I do want to kind of double our sponsorships now to bring on someone else full time. So we have a lot of work to do, but I think that would be really cool. I've even thought about bringing on like sales. That can be really helpful.
Sponsorship sales. Yeah.
Basically, I was talking to a sales guy in a a HR company. They write HR SaaS software, and he sells it. And leads come in, and he just knocks out these sales, and he gets a commission of, he gets a base salary and a commission. And I was talking to him about ideas about how to make that work. Like, how could we bring on salespeople for sponsorships? So I think, there are opportunities there, because honestly, a lot of larger companies find the sales teams beneficial and useful. They look for that. They expect that. So that's something where we could improve. But
yeah. Well, it makes sense. Like, you don't want to spend all of your time like trying to hunt down sponsorships when like you're trying to code the thing, right?
We've also talked about like Muhammad and Francis and I have talked about building like a course, like a certification as an option.
Now you're speaking my language. That's something that me and you need to talk about.
We can talk about it. I just have no time. None of us have any time to do that. That takes a ton of time. So
yeah, no, tell me all about it. Creating content is not a walk in the park, that's for sure.
Yeah, but I'm off channel, I'd be happy to talk about that and get some ideas.
Yeah, for sure. So what are like the most painful use cases that really get a company to actually make like the hard switch from, Nginx or Apache to Caddy, or really from any alternative?
Well, I wouldn't call it a hard switch for most. I think for most of what I've heard of, it's been a pretty relieving switch to Caddy, or maybe there are a few bumps, here or there. But so the thing is, when they work with us, and I say us, I mean me primarily, but also like I have resources through either the maintainers, they're volunteers, but if they want to help, they can. I don't ever expect them to help with like paid sponsorship work, but if they want to, sometimes they just can quickly answer a question. And they're always aware, by the way, when it is like, hey, I have this sponsor, it has this question. So they're never obligated. But I also work with, like, I'm in contact with like Arden Labs, and we can work with them. But the point is, like, so we can help companies get onboarded to Caddy and help them switch. What I have found, though, is that some of the deepest Caddy integrators like Stripe and Framer and such have done it primarily autonomously, like on their own. And I'm familiar a little bit to, some extent or a greater extent with their setups. So I can help them with the switch. And I think what these companies are switching for is because they want to, it simplifies their infrastructure, it reduces their costs, and it lets them do more. So these heavy integrators, they have a lot of custom plugins that are written in Go, obviously. And so they're doing a lot of custom stuff that would otherwise be a separate Go projects or microservices. I think you see a lot of companies kind of consolidating and simplifying. So it lowers their costs. The free, TLS and at scale is a huge win for these companies. So when you're deploying custom domains and you need to serve your customers' domains over TLS, Caddy is the star of the show there. And there's really no great alternative for that. Companies like, I know Squarespace built their own, which is a bit of a bummer, but that was also, I think in the process of building Caddy too. So it wasn't quite there
yet.
Are
you able to spill the beans on if Stripe is using Caddy to like do the SSL for like checkout on third party domains?
I actually don't know the extent to which they're using it. I do know they have upwards of about 1,000 instances, and they have publicly said they're using it to power their internal infrastructure. That's kind of what I know.
Cool. No, that's interesting. When you said like, spinning up SSL on like third-party domains, that was immediately what sprung to mind, is I know that they allow you to like put your domain into Stripe and they'll host stuff for you on your domain, right?
Yeah, we've got companies and sponsors doing that. Approximated.app, for example, that's their specialty.
What are some of the like most unexpected challenges that you ran into building Caddy?
I would say they're not technical. So funding is obviously a huge one. I think just community management and just the project management stuff. Honestly, it's not my strength. Thankfully, our maintainer team is pretty good and reasonable about things. But Yeah, I would say like with Caddy V1, you know, we tried a bunch of different things to like keep the project sustainable, and most were despised. And so that was unfortunate. So that was really challenging. You know, I was really bummed about the telemetry stuff because I thought that was really useful and valuable, and it's benign. It's not sensitive. And the backlash there was really unfortunate.
Are you talking about the Go, like at the level of the Go programming language, or did you do something with telemetry?
Oh, I did something. So like server-side telemetry, it was kind of the only like server-side perspective of the internet globally. Like you can do a lot of client scans, but you don't really have anything from server-side scanning, not scanning clients, but you know, like, I'm not recording any, it wasn't recording anything sensitive. It was just technical things like what cipher suites are presented, and everything was like anonymized and stuff. So, I mean, it was part of my grad school research, but
gotcha.
Anyway, the backlash was really unfortunate because now people are like, they'll ask questions or they have support and I can't give them an answer because I don't have the data to support. Like, oh, I don't know if that's used or not. Like, too bad we don't have telemetry. Like, I don't know what
directives. That's exactly what happened with Go, right? Like Russ Cox announce like we're going to do like telemetry in the tool chain. Yeah. And then there was a huge backlash. And I think they didn't ship it, right?
They shipped it opt-in, which is disappointing because you have opt-in telemetry, you're heavily biased and your sample size is drastically smaller. And so like for my research purposes, that wasn't really an option, not a good one. And so I mean, we did make it possible for you to turn off individual data points if you didn't want them for some reason. But like it was just, so Go faced the same problem and got the same backlash, which is, again, very unfortunate. Because honestly, nowadays, even the telemetry, like when Go proposed theirs, by then the telemetry technology for anonymous, like that's a lot better now, even than it was when I was in grad school. So it was really a bummer because like I think projects should be able to get good telemetry as long as they do it right and they're open, they're transparent about it, they anonymize things and stuff like that. So like, I don't trust a lot of stuff like Windows telemetry.
Well, it's a big difference between closed source and open source telemetry. Like when it's open source telemetry, you can actually go and see and verify that like what you think is being tracked is being tracked.
Exactly. And in my opinion, Go's telemetry, they did it right. And I was really disappointed to see the Go community reject it.
Yeah.
Out of kind of fear, maybe not understanding it. So I think it's going to kind of handicap the Go project a little bit in terms of the data it has, but oh well.
I think a lot of it comes from a fundamental misunderstanding of like how behavioral psychology works. So like when like the whole opt-in, opt-out discussion was happening, I think a lot of people in their brains just go like, oh, opt-in is obviously better. Because it just means everyone who wants to opt in will opt in. But the reality is like probably 70 or 80 or 90% of people would actually be just fine with being with having the telemetry on. But it's just taking the time to go turn it on. Like just nobody's going to bother. And so you probably get like 1% of people actually going and turning it on. Probably not even that. Whereas like with opt out, it's the same, but in reverse, in the sense that only the people that are most opposed to having telemetry going on are going to actually go opt out. So it's actually like a really hard problem to solve. Like if your goal with like an opting system for telemetry was to get all of the people that really don't want to be tracked, not being tracked. And I shouldn't even say tracked because that's like the not sending telemetry data.
I know what you mean. Data. Yeah.
Right. And then like the people that are fine with it in the other bucket, the split probably isn't going to be like 99% and 1%. But like there's no system that we've devised that can actually get the accurate split, if that makes
sense. I know. What I'm saying even makes sense. It's super tricky. Yeah. We looked at this heavy when I was in grad school, and we just could not figure out a good solution to do it opt-in.
To give like one concrete example, I was listening to this podcast, behavioral psychology podcast. It was like, I think it was the UK, like when the UK switched organ donors from being like opt-in or from being opt-out to opt-in. The other way around. It was opt-in and they switched it to being opt-out.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So if you didn't want your organs to be donated, you had to like opt out at the DMV or whatever. It just like completely flipped from like 1% and 99% to 99% and 1%. Like all you're really tracking is like the people that care to check a checkbox, which is fascinating because you could look at that and be like, oh, 99% of people don't want to, you know, donate their organs. But that's just like the completely inaccurate way to look at that data.
Right. Yeah. Because they're the only ones that were that MIT took an action. And anyway, there's a lot of skew. It's very subtle too. So like the research methods, they understand this stuff, and the Go team understands this stuff. And anyway, it's unfortunate. So there were a lot of challenges like that.
But on the plus side, what are like the biggest, what's the next thing coming for Caddy that people should be excited about?
So our community is awesome, and you know, the Go community, the developer community out there is really great. And so there's a lot of contributions coming in. And aside from reviewing those and merging those, and I'm a little behind after, you know, we had our baby a couple months ago. So I've been trying to catch up.
Yeah. So congratulations, by the way. That's...
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to work on, so we just launched kind of a new site, some new marketing pages. There's more I want to do there just based on like my interactions with companies. Like we have this features page that is very, 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 very long and ridiculous to read the whole thing. It's one of those pages that's like find in page friendly. And
yeah,
because we have a lot of like executives or product managers that are like, well, does it do this? And what about this? And so I want to send them a brochure, but it's just a web page. So there'll be pages like this, maybe comparison pages. So marketing pages, I don't know if you want to like look forward to that, but as part of this, we're revamping the documentation. So this is something developers can look forward to, and that is all new docs, basically. Well, not all new, but we are going to restructure things and flesh out more content, get more detailed, try and be more useful. People always clamor for examples, and that's so hard because there are infinite possibilities out there. And if you show someone an example, they'll think it works for them and then it doesn't. And then because they need one little thing different, and I don't know, it's just examples are hard. So I do want to have more examples, but I'm not going to make any promises, but I do want to take the documentation more in depth. Yeah. To help.
Very cool.
Yeah. Right now it's a very reference heavy. Like if you already know what to look for, then our docs are great. But if you're kind of trying to connect the dots, it's a little hard right now. So new documentation, and then we want to improve our test situation, testing. And FrankenPHP was the latest big development. So next year, we're still trying to figure out the roadmap, I think. Probably version 2.8, maybe version 2.9 if we're really productive. But right now, we've got a lot. Like, Caddy already does a ton. And I think we want to kind of improve what we've got. Yeah. I don't have any major features in mind in particular right now.
So it's like bugs, refactors, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you could say it's boring, but also a lot of people love Go because it's mostly just improving what you've already got. So
awesome. No, this is fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about Caddy. Like I said, huge fan of the project. Where can people find you, find Caddy, basically anything you want them to find?
Yeah, well, so the Caddy website, we have a link to a store. You can buy Caddy merch just for fun. You can sponsor us, but I'm on Twitter. I still call it that.
little
disobedience there. Yeah. So I'm mholt6 there. I also run the Caddy account. You can find me on GitHub, mholt. And I don't want to downplay our community either. A lot of times if you reach out on the Caddy forums at caddy.community, I used to read every single thread, but it's just so busy now I can't. So we have our helpers there, Francis, Muhammad, Matthew. Like we have several helpers who will eventually get around to it, but we could always use more helpers. So if you want to get involved in the project, pull requests and stuff are great. Issues are great. They do create kind of a workload for us, you know, because we have to review them and stuff. The more you get involved though, like the more we can spread out the work. So, if you want to get involved in our forums, you can help answer questions. You can become a Caddy expert by doing that. That's really valuable for your professional like CV as well. So I don't know. Those are some things I would recommend.
Amazing. I will put links down in the description below, down in the show notes as well, depending on if you're watching on a podcast player or on YouTube. But thanks again, Matt. We'll talk soon, man.
Yeah. Lane, thanks for the discussion.